Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Tired of all the bugs in your yard? Enjoy your backyard again with Cutter Backyard Ready to Spray Bug Control at Menards. It kills mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, and other insects fast, controlling them for up to 12 weeks. A 32-ounce Ready to Spray container covers up to 5,000 square feet and is on sale now through July 13th. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at
Can't get enough eye-popping, jaw-dropping, heart-stopping reality TV.
It's the best.
Then head to Hey You, home of reality on demand. Stream and download the latest episodes from shows like Keeping Up with the Kardashians and The Real Housewives, same day as the US.
What's more fun than that?
Or binge old faves like The Simple Life and The Hills.
That's hot.
Hey You, reality on demand. Start your one-month free trial now.
You watch the movies, slash flicks, slash tracks for the good, slash bad. It's the Slash Film Cast. For the girls, slash boys, slash old, slash young. Yeah, we watch till the last of the credits is done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Film Cast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. I'm David Chen, and with me are
Devendra Hardwire
and Jeff Cannata.
Welcome to the show, everyone. What we're going to do here today on the podcast, we're going to talk about some what we've been watching and then move on into an in-depth review. This week, we'll be reviewing Searching, the new film starring John Cho that takes place entirely on a computer screen. Really psyched to dive into this one with you, gentlemen. So that's what we got on tap for you. But before we get to any of that, we got to go over some emails. Of course, you can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. You can also email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. And last week on the podcast, I talked about a Netflix original series called Magic for Humans. Devendra, have you heard about this show? You were at a...
I saw the first episode.
Oh,
so, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I quite enjoyed the show. You were at... but you were at Berlin last week, right?
I was there for the IFA trade show. Don't ask me what that actually stands for. It's German, but it's a tech thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And you got to see some like 8K televisions and stuff like that.
I did. Now get ready for that hype cycle. Yeah. Samsung.
You sound so excited about it.
Cause it's such, I mean, I wrote up a big explainer in Gadget, but yeah, you know, 4K, if your screen's under 100 inches, which I assume it probably is, 4K will be, you know, more than fine for most of us.
Four more Ks, dude.
It's four more K, Devendra.
Four more Ks. Your eyes can only perceive so many Ks unless you got your eyeballs right up to it. So that's the big thing. So, like, this is just a big hype cycle that, you know, we can ignore, thankfully. Get yourself an OLED. Get yourself a nice 4K HDR screen, folks.
Do I need a 100-inch screen, or can I do a 27-inch screen and
now,
sit on top of it?
When it comes to size, I do think size does matter. Come on. Yeah. But yeah, I love my 100-inch projector screen, and eventually we will all have giant-ass screens, and then 8K may matter more. Even then, 4K is more than enough. You go to a movie theater, that is a 4K projector, most likely, you know?
Yeah,
and
it's
great.
It's true.
I want to be inside the image. I don't want to know where the image ends and I begin.
Yeah, you just want to... That's the Magic Leap cinema style.
Yeah, you're going to be watching movies in HoloLens in the future.
Maybe.
Okay, so talking about Magic for Humans, a Netflix original series, I got an email from Alex G, who writes into slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Quote, was interesting that you, David Chen, said that Magic for Humans featured long extended takes that proved the authenticity of the magic tricks. Because if you watched again, I think you'd agree that the majority of his tricks are actually edited in a super cutty way and even employ a ton of quote-unquote clean cross-cutting, i.e. solo shots between the magician and audience without the other in the frame, making it really easy to fudge what's going on. This guy really does seem like he has integrity, and I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but if he really is doing everything for real, then whoever is choosing to employ such a cutty style in the show is doing so to the severe detriment of the trick's effects, in my opinion. Anyway, end quote. Also, actually, Alex goes on to write about how it was interesting to hear your discussion on whether the rise in digital effects has ruined magic on TV forever. For me, it definitely has. I just can't lose myself in it when any sort of editing is going on, knowing how easy most of his tricks could be pulled off with basic visual effects. It's going to be live shows for me to get my magic fix. I think it's extending through a lot of Hollywood now, too. I'm pretty sure 10 years from now, people will watch the Halo jump in Mission Impossible Fallout without knowing the backstory of it and totally assume it's an average-grade FX sequence. I also constantly meet people who think Coraline or Kubo are CG animated. Truth in film, as in politics and media, is becoming harder and harder to convey.
Yeah.
So that email comes from Alex. So Alex obviously disagreed with my assessment of Magic for Humans and also writes in that he has lost all sense of wonder in his life and cannot enjoy magic on TV anymore, which, you know, Jeff, you were talking about this last week. I think it's a very common effect when you have visual effects that are so good they can trick you into thinking anything is possible. Then having, you know, street magic no longer has the same effect, right?
Yeah, and I can attest that the most recent magic show that I saw in person, David Copperfield in Las Vegas, which I saw with our own Peter Cerretta, I guarantee you that if I wasn't watching that live, I was blown away by the things I saw. But if I saw those on a TV screen, the exact same tricks, I would have been much less impressed. It is the fact that he manifested something in a room that I was in rather than just seeing other people react to that that made it special. So maybe magic will only kind of be a live medium. Although, you know, I do enjoy these specials still.
Yeah. I remember the David Blaine like specials, like when those were on TV. I was in high school, like, right? Those were fun.
Yeah.
All right. So thanks to Alex for writing in. But yeah, I mean, the world of magic is different now. And I think people will have different reactions to Magic for Humans depending on how much they're willing to believe. Devendra, what did you think of the episode that you saw?
I saw the first episode. It was fun. Yeah. It did remind me a lot of the like the David Blaine shtick, basically, like run up to people and try to, like, you know, freak them out with something.
It is the skill of David Blaine with the extremely cheesy humor of Jeff Cannata, I think, is
there is a lot of that. Yes, I am surprised.
Made in heaven.
I feel like people will punch this guy at some point too. Like, he definitely does things like, dude, you just threw my phone. Like, yeah, you sent it away in a drone. How dare you? Yeah, good luck with this.
Well, I mean, that would match with how often Jeff Cannata has been punched as well for his terrible jokes, right, Jeff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Constantly dodging punches, baby.
Yeah.
Okay, so we are not going to talk about the results of the Summer Movie Wager on this week's episode of the podcast. That's going
to
be
as much as somebody wants to. Yeah.
My understanding is it's still anybody's
game. It's still anybody's game. That's
wide
right. Wide open field. You definitely don't have a 0% chance of winning.
Two outs. Who knows? Who knows who's coming up to the plate at this point? It's unknowable who would win.
But a few weeks ago, I encouraged everyone in the audience to participate in the hashtag SaveDaveWave. And go see movies like The Meg. I also participated myself in the hashtag Gold Open movement and bought out an entire theater to show Crazy Rich Asians. Got this email this week from somebody who works in film distribution. And this person writes in, and they wanted to remain anonymous, quote, "What film distributors let us play in a theater is determined by past performance of what they deem quote-unquote similar films. To clarify, this isn't similar films in relation to genre, like horror or comedy. The industry terms used to describe these films are minority films, like black-centric films, specifically anything with Tyler Perry, art house movies, like indie, liberal, or Oscar bait, and faith-based movies, like small distribution Christian films. In the past year, Latin/Hispanic films have joined the mix as distributors are trying to find the Latin market. This week, Searching is expanding prints, and they are releasing it at our theaters directly in relation to how well Crazy Rich Asians has done at each of our locations." So I'll end it right there. But suffice to say, this is an industry source writing in saying, like, when a movie like Crazy Rich Asians opens big, it actually does make a difference in terms of what you are able to see in a theater. And apparently it's happening in like a week by week basis, which is pretty insane. You know, I shared this with Peter Serretta from SlashFilm.com, and his understanding of how a lot of movie theaters allocate their screens is like these decisions are often made months in advance. But in the new digital age where like you can get a DCP really quickly, you know, who knows how much that's affecting like multiplexes as well as smaller boutique theater chains. So this is one story of how hashtag Gold Open has resulted in a movie like Searching, which also features a primarily minority cast, how that movie is able to be accessed by more people. And so it does make a difference when movies like Crazy Rich Asians open big, and I was very encouraged to hear that from this listener. So just wanted to share that. And yeah, you got to vote with your dollars. You got to be the change you want to see in the world. You got to pay for the movies that you want to see more of. So just wanted to encourage everyone in the audience to do that. And finally, before we get to what we've been watching this week, there's been a piece of film news that Jeff Cannata, it's hit home for you, right?
Yeah, very much so. I don't know if anybody has been following this little drama with regard to the actor Jeffrey Owens. Mm-hmm. You probably, if you grew up in the 80s like I did, you are aware of Jeffrey Owens as the actor who played Elvin on The Cosby Show. He was a charming then, still charming. I can attest now. I met him a while ago. I did a play reading with Jeffrey Owens, so I met him. The nicest guy you could possibly imagine, but he ran into some national news. Found himself at the center of national news because someone spotted him working at Trader Joe's and thought that was worthy of a sort of gotcha style journalism expose on how the mighty have fallen. This guy who is very well known and on a big hit sitcom, now working at Trader Joe's. And I think it was picked up by Fox News and some other places as this sort of ha ha, look at how horrible this guy is doing this shameful thing. You know, you can go into Trader Joe's and see a star of small screen, you know, bagging groceries. Ha ha. And, you know, there's been a significant backlash and I think a well-deserved one. But I wanted to weigh in with my two cents because we have a platform here. And as you said, Dave, it really hit home for me. I mean, Jeffrey Owens lived the dream 26 years ago, we should say. This was in his youth, and many years ago, he was on a hit show. He was a series regular on the biggest television show in the world at the time. Mm-hmm. And that's something that puts significant dollars in one's pocket, but that's 26 years ago.
Yeah. And whatever royalties, by the way, from that is kind of probably a little fucked up now because of things, right?
Well, they've all been pulled from syndication because of the Bill Cosby situation. So it certainly impacted him. He did an interesting interview with CNN. I think he comes off great, as you would expect of a guy. He's a Yale graduate, very well respected actor. But I think, moreover, taking this in a broader perspective, not just his particular situation, there's something weird that happens with actors, right? They're either sort of despised and looked down on or revered. And there's really no middle ground. It's either, you know, and it's a strange thing where when someone says, I want to be an actor or thinks about actors, they think about the 0.1% of the 0.1%. They think about, you know, the Tom Cruises and, you know, Julia Roberts's of the world. They think of the highest earning, most high profile people. It's like if somebody said, I want to start a business, and they go, oh, you're going to be Mark Zuckerberg. You know, he's like, you're going to be the most high profile, biggest earning, rarest of birds in that particular field. Where I think the reality is most people who scrape by a living do so because they're fortunate to be able to work consistently, not because they hit the lottery. And Jeffrey Owens did kind of hit the lottery a long time ago, but he stayed an actor and he mentioned in his CNN interview that he, since The Cosby Show ended 26 years ago, he hasn't had a job that worked more than 10 weeks at a time. And he has a family, and he's, you know, he took a job at Trader Joe's. And I, you know, chose to try to make a living in the arts. I have two kids now. I think every day about what I might have to do. And it's funny, I think this struck me particularly personally, because I have often thought that my backup plan is to work at Trader Joe's. I honestly think about that. Trader Joe's, pretty cool place to work. I actually have a buddy who moved out of LA and got a job at Trader Joe's, and he's so happy. He's a very happy person. Bikes to work and works at Trader Joe's. And so I've often thought, man, if I had to, if push came to shove, if the bottom fell out of everything, I would support my family by sort of doing one of those jobs that are slowly, you know, ending in this world. But still, it is one of those things that I could not believe the contempt that was shown for someone making ends meet, mm-hmm. doing a honest day's work for an honest day's pay, and doing what needs to be done to pay his bills. There was such a strange disdain for that, like how he had sort of sullied himself by doing menial labor. And I just found it so distasteful and offensive. I wanted to speak out on it.
Yeah,
it's incredibly gross. Yeah.
Yeah, it was grotesque. And I think it also, just as you indicated, Jeff, it betrays a complete lack of understanding of the mm-hmm. experience of the vast majority of people who, you know, live in Hollywood and try to make a go of it.
Yeah, actors right. and creatives in general.
Yeah.
Honestly. It's funny that this blows up with Fox News too, because like, this is real America, right?
Right.
This is people working and having several jobs just to make ends meet. But yeah, I guess the moment you get to look at real America, you laugh at them.
Yeah. From their perspective, it should be, you know, they hate Hollywood, right? He's moved into the real workforce, right, from their perspective. So they should be lauding this and saying, oh, good, a Hollywood elite has put on a working man's uniform and gone to work. But no, there's some weird double standard there that makes it something worthy of their disdain. Which
we should point out that, like, I have to admit, Jeff, I went on the full kind of roller coaster of emotions watching the story break. Because on the one hand, this is, you guys have indicated, Fox News was one of the initial sites that picked this up, and it was a disgusting decision by them to do that. And then there was a bunch of people condemning Fox News for picking it up, and in condemning them, they like gave the story more oxygen, right? And allowed the story to spread further. And I was just like, oh, like, I really wish they didn't do that, because, you know, outrage and condemnation is a great way to get clicks and attention. However, seeing Jeffrey Owens, I saw him on CBS this morning, I think, or ABC News giving an interview about it. ABC's Good Morning America talking about it this morning. And he said that he was initially very ashamed and embarrassed when the story broke, but that lasted such a short period of time. Because mm-hmm. he was immediately overwhelmed by all the incredible support for what he was doing, and it was a lovely interview. It made me actually very emotional to see it, because he's talking about how quote, "there is no job that's better than another. It may pay better, it may have better benefits, it may look better on paper, but it's not better. Every job is worthwhile." End quote. And if people hadn't like been outraged and complained about it, he might have never gotten that like second wave of like, you know, big support.
Well, the other thing he said is that he said, if this notoriety leads to somebody offering me an acting job, I would rather them not. He said, I'm not interested in getting an acting job just because someone feels like they need a right or wrong.
Right.
Or,
he said he would audition, yeah, but he doesn't just want to be handed something. Yeah.
Right. If it leads to me getting more auditions and I can compete with my peers and, you know, earn the job, then I'm all for it. But I just think that he's such a stand-up guy. And like I said, I worked with him briefly on a play reading several years ago, and just found him to be such a stand-up guy, such a great person, so warm and generous with his time and attention. I'm not surprised, but also, you know, he handled this with such aplomb, I think. I'm kudos to him, but I think it speaks to a larger issue that obviously I have some personal stake in, but I also think it is really true that there's this weird place that the arts live. You know, no parent wants to hear their kid goes into the arts. Every kid that you meet that goes into the arts, their parents are like, oh God, I worried you would never make a dime. But we also, you know, revere these figures that make the millions and are on the covers of all the magazines and et cetera. It's a weird dichotomy that I don't think our culture has handled well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great – you put it really well, Jeff, when you said actors are often revered or despised, and there is rarely a middle ground. But the fact of the matter is, you know, the vast masses of actors, many of them often work second jobs. Right? Mm. Like many of them. And it just is like
some podcast to make their living. See,
I know. Like some even stoop down to the world of film podcasting, which, like, you know.
Yeah.
I mean.
Don't tell Fox News.
don't tell Fox News about Jeff Cannata's film podcast, or else, you know. It's very unfortunate that it happened the way it did. And I was really torn. I was like, on the one hand, I wish people wouldn't talk about this more. But then the ultimate result was that Jeffrey Owens got a lot of awesome support and then came off looking really, like you said, a stand-up guy, like a very great – like a great individual. And so ultimately I think the result was good. I'm very torn, you know, about like how the internet should have handled this one. But as Vic Digital in the chat room points out – this may be how the Jeffrey Owens assance begins.
there we go.
And I think
there we go.
Yeah,
you know that's.
I know he said he wouldn't just accept a job, but I think Tyler Perry offered him something, so maybe at least that's like, you know, a chance to try out for a role there for something huge.
All right, let's move on to what we've been watching this week. Jeff Cannata, what have you been watching this week?
Well, I had a chance to see the film Juliet Naked. My wife actually really wanted to see this one, and she and I don't get to go to the movies together very often anymore because one person has to stay home and make sure that the children continue breathing. But we had the fortunate experience of having my mom in town for a week to celebrate my son's second birthday and more. And so we got to have a date night and go see Juliet Naked because that was what my wife wanted to see. And it's based on the Nick Hornsby novel. I'm a big fan of Nick Hornsby's writing, and many of the films based on his books have been quite good too. The story of Juliet Naked stars Ethan Hawke and Rose Byrne and Chris O'Dowd. Ethan Hawke plays a sort of revered musician from the 90s who disappeared and had one great album and disappeared. And then Rose Byrne and Chris O'Dowd are a couple. Chris O'Dowd is obsessed with this guy and does a podcast about him and has been trying to figure out what happened to him. And circumstances conspire to have this guy kind of resurface in their lives. It's a romantic comedy. I found it to be really delightful. I mean, it's not the greatest movie in the world. It's a sweet little romantic comedy, but I found it very watchable, fun and funny and sweet. And really different than any kind of romantic comedy I've ever seen, in the sense that it really paints a picture of people with messy lives, very messy, messy lives. And I kind of like that. Nothing is clean. Nothing is easy. Everybody is complicated. Everybody has past relationships or current relationships that are just sort of messy and not clear. And they still kind of navigate their way through that in a charming way. So I don't know. I liked it. It's not, you know, it's not in my top 10 of romantic comedies ever or anything like that, but I found it to be very watchable and worthwhile.
Cool. That's Juliet Naked, and it's out in theaters right now.
That's right.
Anything else you've been watching, Jeff?
Well, this isn't a film, but I wanted to speak to it because it is so cinematic, and that is the new Spider-Man game, which comes out this week. I was fortunate to get an early copy because I do a lot of video game coverage as well. You can listen to my full discussion of the Spider-Man video game on my video game podcast, DLC, which you can find at 5by5.tv/DLC. But I wanted to speak to it on this show because I really think that the new Spider-Man video game from Insomniac Studios is as good or better than any of the Spider-Man films, just from a story perspective. If this, if they had just filmed exactly how this video game presents the cutscenes with the same actors and made it the next Marvel Spider-Man game, I would be like, that's a home run. Marvel knocked it out of the park. It was phenomenal storytelling, really lovely, great acting, and the characters, the casting choices for all of the people in Peter Parker's life are so inspired. I am so impressed. They are offbeat. They're not what you would expect. Aunt May is such an interesting choice for who would play Aunt May. She doesn't look like the comic book version of Aunt May. She doesn't look like the film version of Aunt May. She's something different, but she's so right. And the same is true of many of the characters in his rogues gallery. There's Dr. Otto Octavius is such an interesting take on that character, such an interesting actor to cast. And of course, it's digitally represented, but it is a real actor that they motion captured for all the cutscenes. And the story is just so well presented. It's a slow burn, and there's a lot of really wonderful buildup. It has stakes. It has emotional investment. Mary Jane Watson is giving a lot of time and a lot of agency in the world. She's not just a damsel in distress. In fact, they kind of Lois Lane her. She kind of becomes a very, very much a Lois Lane type, a investigative journalist in this version. And it's great, man. It is really just from a pure cinematic storytelling perspective, worth playing. It also happens to be very fun to play as well on a mechanical level, but for people that listen to this show and like superhero movies and superhero storytelling, don't miss this. It's exclusive to PlayStation 4, but if you've got one of those or are planning to get one, don't miss this game. It's excellent.
Cool. That's Marvel's Spider-Man, and it's going to be out on PS4 soon, right? In September?
On the 7th.
On the 7th. I'm really psyched for this game, and it is crazy that so, you know, I was reading this book, I think it's called The Big Picture by Ben Fritz. It's about it's called The Fight for the Future of Movies. The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. And one of the primary sources is all the emails that were released during the Sony hack. And it is crazy how, like, Sony went from kind of pioneering the modern superhero film with Sam Raimi's Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. To within, you know, 10, 15 years, no longer being able to produce a single good Spider-Man film, right? And then,
Well, we'll see with Venom coming out, guys. It still has some hope on the horizon.
As I said.
Maybe Venom's the one to turn this whole ship around, baby.
They went from Spider-Man 1 in 2001 to now 17 years later. Can't produce a single good Spider-Man film. Meanwhile,
on their own, at least, yeah.
Spider-Man Homecoming, very well reviewed, made a lot of money. And now this Spider-Man game, which is going to be on PlayStation, Sony's PlayStation 4, also extremely well reviewed. So, yeah, what a weird journey that Sony has had with that character. But I am looking forward to playing this game because I've heard it's awesome. So thanks for sharing, Jeff. And you can hear Jeff talk about that game for another 30 minutes on his other podcast, DLC, which I did, and I'd recommend. Devendra Hardwar, you've been watching a couple things.
Yeah, just quickly, I've been watching Disenchantment, the new Matt Groening show that's on Netflix. It's sort of like his same shtick, I guess, like if Simpsons was modern times, Futurama was future times, this is like medieval times, basically.
So he just needs like a post-apocalyptic one, and
I feel like Futurama does that a lot. Like Futurama for one episode will be post-apocalyptic, right? And then they'll reverse time and go back to normal. So I think
he needs a Western one. Yeah. I guess you got to get all the genres, right?
And Futurama has had Westerns, the episodes where they go to Mars, and it's a Martian Western. You know, I feel like Futurama was like the best, aside from early Simpsons. Like Futurama, I think, was like everything Matt Groening was trying to do, and the co-creator for that show, David Cohen. That felt like a good evolution of the Simpsons. This show, it's fine. It's kind of funny. I think the cast is great. Abby Jacobson is the lead. She's a princess who's kind of always drunk, always starting fights, not really quite a normal princess. And Eric Andre is in this as well, and he's hilarious. It's a weird show because it just kind of takes a while to get going, right? You're set up with the initial premise that they're trying to marry her off and she doesn't want to get married and yada yada yada, and it's a lot of that back and forth for most of the season, honestly. I'm about halfway through, but I hear it takes a really interesting turn towards the end. So I'll keep going, mainly because I like Abby Jacobson. And it's kind of sweet. It's about her and her hanging out with her feisty elf and her personal demon. So if you just want some like nice, you want to see something new from Matt Groening, it's worth checking out.
All right. Well, that is Disenchantment. It's on Netflix right now. And Devinger, you watched Upgrade. Now, we've gotten a few emails, a few tweets about this movie, Upgrade. I actually bought the Blu-ray. It's sitting in my Amazon locker at work. I have to pick it up and bring it home to watch it.
I'm also really excited to see this one. I'm anticipating watching. Everybody's been talking about, you got to see it, you got to see it.
Yeah. So what do you think of Upgrade?
It's really fun. This is a fun, like, low-budget, no-frills sci-fi action movie from Lee Whannell. The guy who he co-wrote Saw in Insidious and those movies. He typically works with James Wan. He directed Insidious 3, which was not very good. But this is, I think this feels more like a thing where he could kind of flex his muscles a little. It's about a guy who, he gets in a situation. He gets implanted with a computer chip that makes him super powerful. The weird thing about this movie is that the trailers, or the TV spots they were doing for the past couple months, have been pretty awful, honestly. Like, this movie looked like a joke. It also looked really strange, especially after we started seeing Venom trailers, where it looks like the same movie starring the same guy, because it's Logan Marshall Green in full-on, like, Tom Hardy clone mode, basically. but this movie is, I think it's really fun. Like, it's definitely low-budget, but it gives us a cool vision of the future. It's kind of dirty. And the action is really interesting too. Like, once you get into, the things they can do with this computer chip and the way Lee Whannell shoots it, I think the choreography is quite good. It's nothing like, it's maybe not as balls to the wall as maybe some other sci-fi action movies, but it's a lot of fun, really interesting. It's like a Black Mirror episode that goes hard on action. And occasionally is also super gory and violent and in a fun way, I think. So if you like your, down and dirty, low budget sci-fi action movies, this is right up there.
Cool. That's Upgrade. It's available on video on demand and on Blu-ray right now. It's directed by Lee Whannell. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to checking it out myself. Speaking of extremely fun movies, First Reformed by Paul Schrader.
Yes.
No, I'm just joking. I mean, that is not extremely fun. So I saw First Reformed on Blu-ray, and the new Paul Schrader movie with Ethan Hawke. The premise of the movie, as Devinder pointed out, is that
we're fucked.
Like it's about like what do we do in the face? How do you bring a child into this world in the face of like our global warming future? Right.
And, oh, so it's a documentary about my life.
Yeah, that's right. Guys, a couple weeks ago, I let drop what some would consider to be a major spoiler about the film The Meg during the course of an episode, and people wrote in they're really pissed, and it came out of nowhere, no warning. We almost always give some kind of warning, like spoiler warning for The Meg, da 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 da. what is good for the goose is good for the gander, because I was listening to a film podcast recently that shall remain nameless that was reviewing a completely unrelated film to First Reformed, like not even close, has zero to do with First Reformed. And they just freaking dropped a major spoiler about this film right at the beginning of the movie. And I was just like, what the F, guys? Like, totally uncool. So, I am just, I have been served, as it were. And so I feel really bad about dropping that Meg spoiler. And I have also now experienced the pain of having a movie spoiled completely out of nowhere.
Something just at the same level of value as the Meg.
The same level of artistic value. That's correct. Yeah. One is going to be nominated for Oscars for Best Picture and Best Actor, and the other one stars Ethan Hawke.
Yeah.
So, okay, First Reformed.
I think you should have mentioned that we have spoilers for You Got Served.
that someone gets served in that movie? Okay, so...
Someone does indeed get served, and we should have not spoiled that.
I will not spoil anything about First Reformed, except to say, guys, this movie's bananas.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. and it's very provocative, and it is really well made. And I don't even want to I can't even really talk about how it's well made without spoiling anything. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to say anything about it. But I'll just say, like, the visual style of the vast majority of the film is extremely distinctive. Like, the camera almost doesn't move at all and frames these characters in these extremely stark and very often symmetrical compositions that is just very, very striking. There's only, what, like, six speaking roles in the entire film, mm-hmm. seven speaking roles in the entire film.
It's a really small movie.
Yeah, really small movie. Feels almost like a play, right? The way it's shot and edited. And so... I think it's worth checking out. It takes some really big chances. Mm-hmm. It's like
I would also say, don't judge this movie based on like the first 15 minutes or even 30 minutes. Like, yeah. Go with it.
Yeah,
go with the journey.
You got to go until the end. You got to follow this thing all the way to the end. Is all I got to say about that. So I would recommend it. I think it's something that I'm going to be thinking about for a very, very long time.
Yeah. The ending of this movie is one of those things that floored me when I first saw it in the theater. And I think I just stood, like, sat there in a daze, and I looked around, and just everybody else in the theater was just like, what did we just see?
Yeah, you just spend, like, days thinking about it. So it's worth checking out. It's First Reformed. It's available right now on Blu-ray and on video on demand. But it is not not a family-friendly movie, not a feel-good, pick-me-up kind of movie.
I mean, it is family-friendly in that there is no, you know, it's not like it's a movie...
Yeah.
I guess there's no like overt sexuality.
Yeah,
there is
no
a bit
overt
of
sexuality
violence.
Or violence. Yeah,
it's more like, true. Do you not want your kids to be exposed to the horrifying future that the world they're growing up into may be doomed? You know, then it's not family friendly. Yes.
Yeah. So Jeff, definitely watch this with your wife. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm actually very interested to watch this with my wife. Are you being facetious?
Yes, I was, but it's. I mean, it's a movie. I think everyone should watch.
I watched this movie with my very pregnant wife too, and she was fascinated by it too. So it is like my initial pitch for it was, what if Taxi Driver, but starring a priest who lost his faith? Basically that. Yeah,
it's a challenging. I would say it's a challenging film. I would say it is
one that you know, like, it will have parents having a conversation, start conversation with one another, because we are into that kind of stuff.
Very possibly. I don't know. I think when I looked at it, I have the Voodoo version of it, voodoo.com. You know, because like when I redeemed the digital copy, and it was like. I think it had like 2.5 stars, right? It was like the average review. So it's like you can kind of get a sense of how polarizing a movie like that is by looking at the aggregate reviews. And I would say, this one is pretty freaking polarizing. I can see why it's polarizing. So, but yeah, great performances and a lot to think about. And there's a great piece at Vulture about the ending of the film that I would recommend to anyone that really does a good job of explaining what is going on. So.
Paul Schrader, you still got it.
He still got it. Still got it. One other thing I wanted to mention, which is that this movie does something that very few films I've seen do, very few kind of movies that I enjoy have done, which is it kind of explores a little bit what it's like to be a pastor, you know, what it's like to run a church, and kind of... what the implications are if you're running like a mega church versus running a church that, you know, only a few dozen people go to every week, and how there's
a lot
kind
of whiskey
this...
in your cereal, huh? Man.
Yeah. There's kind of this hierarchy of churches and like a lot of social capital that comes with running like this big church. And it explores that in kind of an interesting, like, I don't see that tackled very often in movies in mainstream, or I guess this isn't mainstream, but like, in secular movies, of which I would describe this as one, and I thought that was very fascinating as someone who grew up in the church. So it's First Reformed. It's available right now on Blu-ray and on video on demand. Wanted to also mention this movie I saw called A Fantastic Woman. Have you guys heard of this movie? I believe it won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film last year. It was directed by Sebastian Lelio, and I'll read the plot summary from IMDb. Marina, a transgender woman who works as a waitress and moonlights as a nightclub singer, is bowled over by the death of her older boyfriend. And it stars Daniela Vega as a transgender woman. And this is a really well-made and moving film. You know, I remember Roger Ebert's the thing that came to mind, you know, about that when I watched this movie was about how like movies are empathy machines, right? And this movie really puts you into this woman's situation and lets you experience the world as she experiences it, which is to have people treat you like a freak, to question your motives and your biology, and to basically be forced to put up with a bunch of indignities that, you know, cishet people don't need to put up with. And I found it to be very powerful, and I'd recommend it to anyone who wants to understand, you know, what a transgender person can go through in contemporary society. So that's A Fantastic Woman. I watched it on Blu-ray, and it's also available on video on demand. Highly recommended. And finally, I had a chance to watch the entire season 2 of Ozark, which is out on Netflix right now. Wow. And I'm not going to say – I'm going to say almost nothing about it because Jeff and I are hopefully going to do an After Dark or maybe a full review or something about it in the next few weeks.
Yeah, baby.
But suffice to say, recording this on September 4th, Ozark was released August 31st. I watched all 10 – it's 10 hours. It's not just 10 episodes. Like every episode is an hour long. And I finished the entire thing in like 3 days. And I wouldn't do that for a show unless I at least moderately enjoyed it. You know what I mean?
That's a lot of Ozark.
It's a lot of Ozark. It's a lot of Ozark. And I just can't quit this show. I mean, I think it's
so good.
I consider it to be like empty calories mostly. You know, like but the thing is, like, the show is basically a bunch of people who are really good actors having tense confrontations with each other. That's like the 95% of the show, right?
What do you need?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically like that's all. Amazing. That's all I want out of shows is like, and it's very atmospheric. The whole show is shot in this rather oppressive, you know, dark bluish cool color palette, but it has some really incredible actors. Laura Linney doing, in my opinion, some of the best work, maybe not some of the best work, but some of my favorite work of her career in season 2 of the show. And Jason Bateman doing a great job, not only as an actor, but also directing several of the episodes. I really like the show, guys. I mean, I've read many reviews that basically people just don't like it. They think it's...
I couldn't finish season 1. Like, yeah. I don't want to yuck your yum, guys, but I could never get away like, man, this is... So this is Breaking Bad again,
yeah,
but different.
A lot of people see it as a Breaking Bad wannabe, except it's not as good. And I can't actually dispute that. I actually don't think it's as good as Breaking Bad.
If you want that flow again, I can understand. Like you just want that hit.
I want that hit. Yeah. I want that.
Yeah.
I want that feeling of Breaking Bad-esque stuff. I
meanwhile, Better Call Saul is over here. It's like so much, in many ways, better than Breaking Bad too. But
Better Call Saul is a great show, and is definitely a better show than Ozark, in my opinion.
But enjoy.
Here's the problem with Ozark is many, not even some, many of the characters are cartoonishly evil. Like, and actually, that describes most of the characters on the show. There's nary a sympathetic character in this entire set of characters. Not even the protagonist, you know, the protagonist family. Like, just everyone is just completely despicable or has many despicable elements about them.
It says so much about the inherent charm of Jason Bateman and Laura Linney that you still want to watch them.
Yeah. So I polished it off in a few days. I still enjoy the show. I'd recommend it. And it definitely goes in some really interesting directions after season 1. And Jeff, I look forward to talking about it with you. You have seen 0 episodes so far, right, Jeff?
Of season 2, yeah. I mean, I devoured season 1, but just haven't – my wife and I itching to start it up. We just haven't had a chance yet.
It definitely feels like a punishing length of episode. Like every episode is six. You know, I don't think every episode needed to be 60 minutes long. You know what
I'm sure it feels more punishing when you try to mainline it in 2 days. Dave. It's a little different when those of us sip it like a fine wine.
Yeah, perhaps, Jeff. So that's Ozark, something I've been watching this week. It's on Netflix right now. Before we get to our review, we want to thank all the people who donated to the show. Declan Glynn, Todd Hampton, David Mason, Stefan Furstel, Marcus Trimble, and Vyabhav S. from Brooklyn, New York City. Thanks so much for your contributions. Thanks also to new subscribers Diane Capoyanis, and David Sillen for contributing at a regular.
Can't get enough eye-popping, jaw-dropping, heart-stopping reality TV.
It's the best.
Then head to Hey You, home of reality on demand. Stream and download the latest episodes from shows like Keeping Up with the Kardashians and The Real Housewives, same day as the US.
What's more fun than that?
Or binge old faves like The Simple Life and The Hills.
That's hot.
Hey You, reality on demand. Start your 1 month free trial now.
Regular rate per month of $2 or above. If you want to support this podcast, help us defray the costs of seeing movies and putting on the show, you can always go to paypal.me/filmcast. It's paypal.me/filmcast. Or go to slashfilm.com and click on the slash filmcast tab. Use the links on the side of the page. We really appreciate all the donors who are helping us to make this podcast what it can be. Of course, never donate if it causes any kind of hardship in your life. But for those who are able to, we are extremely grateful. Let's move on to our review this week of Searching.
911, what's your emergency?
I'm calling to report a missing person.
Okay, who is this regarding?
My daughter.
I'm the detective assigned to your daughter's case. I need to know how everything unfolded.
Understood.
I think we're gonna go late, like, all night.
One, after a study session, Margot didn't return home.
Margot Kim? School has her marked as absent today.
Two, she didn't attend school on Friday.
My daughter is in a lesson with you right now?
Margot canceled her classes 6 months ago.
And three, she's been transferring funds for the last 6 months. We'll handle the ground investigation. But as a parent, you can help us with who your daughter talks to. Is that something you can do?
Yes. Do you mind answering some questions for me to help?
Did see her eat lunch alone.
On Thursday?
Every day.
That was from the trailer for Searching, the newest film, the first film, I should say, and I'm going to try to pronounce his name correctly, but I might butcher it, Anish Chaganti wrote and directed this movie with Sev Ohanian. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. After his 16-year-old daughter goes missing, a desperate father breaks into her laptop to look for clues to find her. This movie stars John Cho and Sarah Soan, as well as a few different women playing Margot, the daughter that goes missing. Michelle Lah plays her in what you see her in the majority of the movie. And the entire thing takes place on a movie on a computer screen.
And on a
movie screen. And Anish Chaganti, I listened to an interview with Anish on the Ringer podcast. It's a great interview. I actually tried to get Anish on this episode of the podcast of the Slash Filmcast, but I could not make it happen. But you know, next best thing, listen to the Ringer podcast, the Big Picture podcast with Anish. Anish is 27 years old. And he worked at Google for a few years making commercials. And if you've seen Google commercials, they're amazing. And many of them take place on a computer screen. So he really cut his teeth doing, you know, learning how to elicit human emotions from just showing stuff on a computer screen. Then spent a couple years in Hollywood making this movie. It debuted at Sundance this year. And now it's out in theaters. I think it made around $7 million over Labor Day weekend. So I can't imagine it cost more than $7 million to make. So I think it's probably going to do pretty well. And so the question is, Jeff Cannata, you know, there's many movies at this – or not many, but like a few movies at this point that have taken place completely on a computer screen. But being on a computer screen can feel gimmicky. It can be an impediment rather than something that facilitates cinematic experience or eliciting of human emotions. Do you feel this movie, Searching, succeeded where others might have failed?
Well, let me tell you before I answer that question, Dave, that I straight up did not want to watch this movie. Because of all those things that you illustrated there, outside looking in, I thought, I don't have the patience for this gimmick.
This is cinema evolving, Jeff. Come on. Join us.
I know that there have been a number of these. I've seen a number of these kinds of movies.
By the way, the idea, because this all started with Timur Bekmambetov, and he Unfriended was one of the first things he produced. It's the concept they're calling Screen Life. So he's trying to make it a thing. He's trying to make more people, make movies like this. Yeah.
Did not look forward to this going in. And I think Searching for me is maybe my biggest surprise of the year so far. I thought it was phenomenal. I really enjoyed it very much. And I think that the revelation for me was how not a gimmick it is mostly, at least for the first, I don't know, two acts of this movie. It is it is not just a clever way to tell the story. It's an essential way to tell the story. In fact, it is the only way to tell the story, because we've all seen films where they struggle to find a way to make compelling the action of our main character sitting at a computer and finding out information.
Tom Cruise typing in Job in Mission Impossible 1, and that whole
indeed.
It was like a night action scene almost set in his hotel room of him furiously typing. So compelling.
And this is a problem that many movies run into in the digital age, right? In the information age, when what makes sense in a plot in a movie's investigation element is that a person gets on the computer and tries to figure stuff out. That makes sense. That's the world we live in. We live in a world where you get on a computer and you find out information. But that's not cinematic. It's inherently not cinematic to have your actor sit down at a computer and start typing. This movie solves that by living inside the computer screen, and it gets a lot of it gets a lot of things as a result. It gets a lot of wonderful benefits as a result. First of all, what it does is smartly, and I think probably because of his experience working at Google, it knows that let's not fake any of this. Let's not create our movies make their like splugel or whatever it is, you know. It's like they always come up with some stupid analog for the tech, or they don't want to pay for the rights to actual Windows, so they come up with some prop guy or some visual effects guy has to come up with some fake interface for a computer. No, what's so smart here is that this looks like what we do every day and have done for decades of our lives. It plays out exactly as you would play it out. And in fact, it's even a bigger point that I'm trying to make. What John Cho does in this movie is what smart people would do in this situation. He gets to work, man. He gets to work.
He makes a spreadsheet.
He uses the resources at his disposal to smartly start working the problem. And I love movies where our main character works the problem. I've always enjoyed that idea of a smart person being smart, trying to figure it out alongside them, so that I'm never ahead of the actor of the character, because they're doing the smartest way through that problem in real time. And this is what you would do. In fact, it reminded me, I'll tell a quick anecdote. I went to Lisbon with my wife. We went to Lisbon and France. And while I was there, there was a fan who I interacted with and asked for some recommendations of things to do there. And he said, "Hey, I would love to meet up with you and show you around a little bit." And I said, "Awesome. So I met up with him, and my wife stayed at the hotel, and she was, you know, a little wary of this idea at all of meeting up with someone, a stranger, ostensibly a stranger. And then we ended up staying out longer than I had told her, which was a huge mistake on my part. But she started getting really panicked, thinking that I had been murdered by some crazed fan. So she and her sister literally did this movie. They like got on their computers and they figured out a way to like track this guy down and find his cell phone and call him. So we're driving back and I get a call and it's his girlfriend going, "Hey, I just got a call from Jeff's." I think she was my wife at that point. She's Jeff's wife, and she really wants to know where you guys are. And I was like, "Oh man, the fact that she got that to happen."
Yeah, that is so creepy. Like that is terrifying when you get the call from a source that like you just in your head you're putting together all the pieces of everything that had to happen for that call to happen. Yes. Right.
Yes. And it was bad. It was one of the biggest mistakes I've made in our relationship, because you know she was just really distraught and thinking that I was had been abducted. But the later on, hearing the story about how she and her sister, like what they did, it's basically this movie. It's like they got on the computer and they just started using all the resources that we all have at our disposal on the internet. And so searching so brilliantly conveys that. It's like it's the best way to dramatize that is like live inside that screen, the how information is revealed. And what it actually ends up being is this stripping down of a mystery. It is like cutting all the fat, because there are no scenes in this movie, really, at least in the first two thirds. There are no scenes. There are just – it's just pure clues. It's just like data presented to you of clues and leads in this mystery. And it's like this is really cool. This is almost like watching a point-and-click adventure game play out in real time in front of me. And it was so fun to sort of be thinking through it with our main character and thinking about what he would do. And it, you know, it is dramatized, but we like almost know nothing about John Cho, you know, what, who he is or where he works or what he does, like very little, but it's cool because it's like all the non-essential stuff is stripped away. It's just like, here is the most, you know, intense thing that could happen to a person. Their child is missing. Here's what they would do and what they would really do. Like, this is what any person with a computer could potentially do. And that alone, it's so cool that the filmmakers understood that alone is super compelling. And watching, just stepping through that process is like edge of your seat entertainment. I do have some qualms with where it goes. And I do think that I wish at one point, I give credit to the filmmakers for sticking to this idea. Like, we're always going to be inside a computer screen. But I really would have loved – there's a very specific point that I'll talk about in spoilers where I wish the movie had gone, oh, now we're in a conventional film. You know, like, oh, you've watched this all on a computer screen up until now. Now we're in a conventional film. I think it would have been a really cool moment to, like, be in a conventional movie for just a few minutes. But it didn't do that, and I wish it had. So I have some qualms with sort of – the last act of the movie, but overall I find it easy to recommend this movie. It was a complete surprise to me. John Cho is fantastic. It's a really cool, interesting, fun mystery.
All right, that's Jeff's thoughts on Searching. Devendra Hardwar, your thoughts?
Oh yeah, I love this movie. I talked about it a bit when I first saw it, I think almost a month ago at this point. It is, you know, Unfriended was fine. I thought that felt like the whole Screen Life thing was a gimmick. Whereas here, it is so interesting and so compelling. Like, it starts off with like a, you know, creating your first Windows XP account thing. And it's like, it is so instantly nostalgic. All those sights and sounds. And like, you think about how much of your life is wrapped up in this technology, right? You go back, if you have an old computer laying around, if you open that thing back up, that is pure nostalgia. And how much of your life is just like trapped in there as data? I think this movie plays with all that really well. But at the same time, it's also like genuinely cinematic too. I think it does a better job than Unfriended of like making things like John Cho creating a spreadsheet and going down the list of potential people who kidnapped his daughter. It looks interesting. It's more compelling than usual, I'd say. The mystery itself is really good. The big downside, I'd say, for this movie, at least for that opening montage, is the score probably needed a little more work. I feel like at least with that bit, that definitely felt just like the Dear Sophie thing from Google, that one of their first ads yeah. that was widely praised. Felt a little too bombastic, a little too marketing type. Music, but overall, like, eventually that just kind of disappears too.
Still made me cry, man.
Yeah, well, yeah, it evokes an emotional response, but it feels just as, like, I think it hurts that sequence, basically, because it feels just as manipulative as, like, a two-minute Google ad has to be to make you cry about typing something into a search box, right? But yeah. I think the movie recovers from that, and you know, there's just so much more going on. We learn about these characters, aside from that opening, right? We don't know that much about John Cho's character, but we learn more about him and the way he works, like, just looking at his desktop and, like, what information is there and how is he thinking. I think it's a really interesting exploration of, like, what our technology says about us. Mm-hmm. And also just the way it's filmed, too. Like, they used GoPro cameras, kind of just pointed, you know, at the actors, at John Cho and Deborah Messing at some point too, and the girl who plays his daughter. Like, it's all, it's very different. And I got a chance to chat with Anish, the writer, Sev, and John Cho. So you can check out that interview at Engadget. It was really interesting to hear this from John Cho. Like, he found it to be a really difficult experience too, because it's literally just him sitting at a table, you know, in front of a, you know, mock computer and looking at a GoPro. There are no other actors there. And it's just the crew. And Anish, like, kind of giving him help. So as good as John Cho is here, and I think they capture some nuances that you wouldn't get with a typical, like, you know, camera setup. Like, since we're looking at him face on almost, it's so different. But he doesn't want to do something like this again, because it was so hard for him to do it as an actor, like, actually act to this GoPro.
Because he's acting, he gets acting against no one. I don't even think he and Deborah Messing I don't believe they shot their scenes at the same time, even, right?
Yeah.
So
he's
just acting against the script or someone in an ear with it, you know, speaking to him in an earpiece.
Yeah, and just like staring at a blank, you know.
You can kind of feel that a little bit, especially mm-hmm. with some of the. I think John Cho is excellent, but there are definitely a few sort of just voiceover actors that they used that just felt like not quite up to snuff. You know,
it's a little bit extra polished. I feel like if they do another one of these, like, maybe they'll have a bigger budget and, you know, more people to tap into. One thing that did kind of annoy me, though, is this is another movie where, despite living entirely on a computer screen, the mouse movements are all, like, super smooth. Like,
that's not
robotic.
How you, robotic. That's not mouse. How you use your mouse. That's how I use mine.
I'm not a robot with the non-wavery mouse movements. If we're gonna be real, I feel like you can even tell, like, the franticness of, like, how somebody's mouse cursor moves and, like, how fast somebody types. I think that all tells you something about a character too. So, like, there's certain things that I would have liked to see done differently as well. As a mystery, though, and as an exploration of this new screen life type framing device, I think it's fascinating. Definitely check out my interview at Engadget, because we had a good chat, and hopefully we'll get Anisha on the show at some point too to talk more about this.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I'm on board with the screen life, but okay.
I think
even though
this,
you were very much surprised by this movie, but yeah,
I think this movie
just as a term.
Overall, I think this movie is a success, and I think. You should check it out, because I do think it represents a milestone in filmmaking. I do think that we have never before seen a movie that takes place on a computer screen that works as well as this movie. I've seen Unfriended, the first one at least, and yeah, like you said, Devendra, it was okay, but, like, this movie is much more ambitious. It's trying to make you feel a far greater set of emotions, and I think it really works. So if there's any takeaway you have from my thoughts, is that you should still go check this out. Here are a few things I really like about it, and then I'm going to get into some things I don't like. Then let's dive into spoilers. What I really like, this movie respects technology, right? It actually goes to the trouble of, like, understand, like, this is how you would reset someone's password. Like, it actually is a realistic depiction.
Authentication.
It's a realistic depiction of how someone would actually use these services, which is shockingly rare. in our day and age. It's always some. Yeah. Go ahead.
And it's weird that it's rare because there's nothing anybody is more familiar with than this.
Yeah.
You know, we all know exactly how this works. And why wouldn't you show it exactly as it's supposed to be? You know?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, because as Devinder pointed out, it's uncinematic, you know, because it's not good for the pacing, you know, whatever. But there is some value in seeing these platforms work in the way that you know that they work. And on that note, I thought in general, Jeff, they did invent UCAS.
Yes.
That was one invention that they made. But everything else, like Tumblr, Instagram, all that stuff, it felt like the people who made this, unsurprisingly, understood how all these platforms work, understood how a teenager might use all these platforms, and understood how a parent might hack into a teenager's accounts on all these platforms.
And by the time we get to UCAST, they've already won so many brownie points of actually using all the correct tech that I forgave that.
Yeah, you're like these people, like, they know their stuff. We can give them a little latitude when it comes to making things.
And there's certainly some like quick fixes, right? Like the daughter has no password on her laptop, and this movie would be nowhere if that laptop was locked.
Right.
Like nothing. You can't stop the two-factor. You can't do anything. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but you know, some people don't have passwords on their laptops. You know, it could be a
parental thing, right? Yeah. Like you cannot, block out your machines from us.
It does give you some good ideas, though, Jeff. Like for her Facebook, one of her accounts, she used as her recovery email address, like one of her parents, right? So
right, which you actually, they seed that in the beginning with her mom setting up the Facebook account.
Mm, yep.
In the early intro, which is like, it's so brilliant. Yeah, of course, like she wouldn't think to change that now that she's 15. Just be, you know, her mom set it up 5 years ago when she was 10 or whatever. You know,
good things to think about, guys, when you have kids that are that old. Set your
I'm terrified. Like set one thing about this movie is the idea that as a parent, right, you will just. It's so hard to know what your kids are doing in their lives, but also in their online lives. And it's like, what reality are they in now? Do they have friends? Who are these people? Are they just streaming their entire lives? Where are they streaming? What's going on? There's a lot. There's a lot to worry about.
Yeah. So love that it respects technology. Love that it is able to, like, it makes creative use of technology. There's stuff here, like the whole thing basically takes place on a screen. There's stuff that's like on a screen that, like, it's like, okay, would that really be on a screen? You know,
FaceTime all my lead detectives.
it makes it work. But there's many scenes that take place, like when you open FaceTime on your computer. It opens up a camera, right? And some people just leave that on, right? I've left it on a few times, and that's a completely realistic thing to do.
It's a whole movie right there, Dave. Just leave it.
Right there. So anyway, the way the movie uses technology is very smart and very creative, and I really love that about it. Okay, so these are some of the things I like about the movie. What I don't like, well, first of all, because of how accurate it is, unfortunately, this movie will become very dated very quickly. I think, like, within 5 years, it will look ancient because I should point out, like, one thing that this movie gave me an appreciation of is the Mac OS. Like, all the work – like, seriously, it's like a very expressive OS, you know, like – all the work that goes into the OX, the designers, right? Like speech bubbles, like the dot, dot, dot popping up in the – like all this stuff is used to like express emotion, like clicking on a window and it pops – you know, all this – like it's actually like really remarkable how expressive an operating system can be. And I think the movie does a great job of like bringing that out in the Mac
also
operating.
I would say the filmmakers themselves did a fantastic job of – maximizing that. Like, it does a wonderful thing of showing us something that is typed and then deleted as a way of seeing inner thoughts that aren't actually expressed by the characters. You get to see hidden interior monologue that way, which is brilliant. It's a brilliant device.
Agreed completely. So that's another thing that the movie does really well. Okay. Now, there have been movies that take place in like one location, right? Or where you're seeing a character in a really short period of time. I'm thinking of like Buried with Ryan Reynolds and Steven Tobolowsky. I'm thinking of like Locke, that Tom Hardy movie. And now Searching, right? And these movies take place where it's in a small confined space. In the case of Buried, the character was in a physical coffin. The whole movie took place in a coffin. And in the case of searching, it takes place kind of on a computer screen. The character goes around and travels to different places, but like the whole movie, you're experiencing it through a computer screen.
And we go to multiple computer screens.
Yeah, we go to multiple computer screens. But I feel like these movies suffer from something, which is that you're only seeing the character in a state of great distress.
Right.
And
right.
often they're not acting at their best. Like when I say acting, I don't mean performing. I mean like Ryan Reynolds' character in Buried was an asshole. You know, and I didn't care whether he got out of that coffin alive or not because he was an asshole. But at the same time, I probably wouldn't be at my best if I was in a coffin buried alive. You know what I mean? So you're seeing characters like only like primarily like 90% of the movie, you're seeing the characters in a state of like great distress where they're like, you know, acting really angry and not happy with people. And I think it makes it hard to sympathize with them. I think it. Makes
really?
It more, yeah.
Like, this movie? You have a hard time sympathizing with him?
A little bit. That's what I'm saying. I think the movie still works, but I think, like, you know, he acts like a jerk to many, many people in this movie, and it's like you only get to see him as a non-jerk for a tiny percentage of the film.
Even at the beginning, like, he's still kind of
an asshole
dad.
In the beginning, you know?
He's like, annoying dad. Yeah. Take out the trash.
Yeah.
Come on.
Exactly. So,
well, but that's his arc, too, is to...
Yeah.
Yeah. So... But anyway, so for me, that part is still kind of like, I don't know how that aspect works for me. And then I really feel strongly, and we're going to talk about this momentarily, but I really feel like the movie kind of goes off the rails in the final third of the film.
I agree.
And,
that's what I agree.
Yeah, and so we can talk more about that, but like it gets really, really silly, in my opinion.
A whole lot of herring up in here.
Yeah, but I didn't.
I don't think it ruins the film.
I agree. There's enough good things here that I still recommend it. Let's just put it this way. I really wanted to take this movie like extremely seriously. And then some things happen that make me like less inclined to take
it seriously.
It's
so grounded and so true for so much of it. And then it just goes, oh, we're in Bunkers Town.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Okay. All right. So those are our overall thoughts. But why don't we dive into spoilers for Searching starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
Can I see this coming?
No.
But you won't find it because, of course,
you're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret now.
You want to be fooled.
So, Devendra, I'll just say, the opening montage. I mean, my wife and I were both like crying, you know?
It works.
Me too, man.
It's very moving.
Despite that score, it works. Yeah.
I thought the score was fine, and I think, I agree, it does sound very much like a Google commercial. But you basically, the opening of this film, Searching, you experience this entire woman's like 10 years of her life through a computer screen. And it's incredible to contemplate, like you said, Devendra, how much of our lives are tied up in these screens and how much information we give to our devices.
Will future generations like look back at our calendars and be like, you know, is that something you pass on to your, you know, kin when you die to like, look at my shit, basically. Like, this is the history of my life. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's so many, I mean, I came home and told my wife, like, I just protect yourself. I can't be without, you know, I'm worried now. It was one of those things where you look back and you go, oh yeah, you would have all of these videos now. I mean, I think we're the first generation to have just copious amounts of memories of
it's
people.
Crazy. Yeah. And I'm now terrified about what my kids are going to hear from, like, our podcast 10 years ago or something, right?
Yeah.
It's not going to be good.
I remember during our review of Chappie, you're like, if I ever have a daughter, I'm going to regret it for the rest of my life, you know?
Yeah.
And
don't make that mistake.
It's going to really cut her deep when she hears that, Devendra. basically, I'm saying don't listen to our review of Chappie is the moral of this story. So
you mean the one that was quoted on the cover of the box art?
Yes, and that is forever to our disgrace. But was it? I don't think that was from our. I don't think that was from the podcast. Oh, no, that was from your review, probably, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so but you know, I think my wife put it really well when she said, "It's a pretty high bar that a movie needs to surmount to have one of the main characters be basically a sociopathic killer, right? And I don't think this movie really surpassed that bar. And it's just because you just don't have enough of the relationship between, you know, you don't, because of the construct of the film taking place on a computer screen, you just don't get enough of who this Deborah Messing character is.
You think she's a sociopathic killer? Because she's, I mean, I wouldn't say she is.
Okay, sociopathic is too strong.
What the movie sets up is this is, you know, she's a parent, she's doing whatever she can to protect her shitty son. And
right. In the same way that he's doing that, whatever he can to protect his daughter. Yeah.
Okay, you're right. Not sociopathic. Yeah. That's not fair. Douglas Rutnerack in the chat room is saying she's not sociopathic. It's about what parents do. Yeah, but just,
it's very blunt. I give you that.
That someone would be capable of that. You know what I mean? This is not just. Hey, I'm going to figure out a way to cover up my son's crime. This is I'm going to murder another human and extract a confession out of them before I do that. Like, that's just a lot to pin on this character. Yeah. And I don't think
made it harsh, too, was that all this happened and nobody checked on the girl. Like, she didn't, I guess, if you're going with this lie, you're just going to live this lie. But at least, like, I don't know.
Yeah, like, try to save her, you know, like.
Something. Yeah, that hit me hardest, I think.
Well, I'm not so much, I find it hard. My credulity isn't strained by her. It's strained by the rest of the police department. You know, they're like, she's like, hey, guys, I volunteer for this one. And they're all like, okay, we're all cool with that.
We're all cool.
Just let us know what you need. Just let us know where not to look.
She's like, don't look over here. It's fine. I guess they don't have drones or anything to like really do large scale aerial, you know, searches or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I thought this movie was both very smart about how social media operated. Like, there's this montage of like how this guy becomes a meme that I thought was real. And the girl who said she didn't really know her friend to like then putting on this whole YouTube show about how this was her best friend. Like, I thought that was all very, very smart. But then like the way it handles local news, I thought was pretty rough. Like, I just don't believe that local news would devote this many resources, but who knows? Who knows?
But I will say that's all real local news stations. Those are all the stations I grew up watching in the Bay Area.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
APIX and all those.
It also feels really legit. Like, if you remember, there was that that awful story, right, about the tech reporter and his family, and they were lost. Remember? It was like Oregon or something. And somebody I grew up watching on tech TV and everything. And like that, there was that was national news. So I don't know.
All right,
I don't know.
No, fair enough. It's
but I do think that the moment he determines that he puts together the fact that she was at that lake and we see him like grab his keys and leave. That's the moment it should have switched to a normal conventional film. Like as soon as he leaves his computer screen, I think it would have been awesome to just like, now we're in a real movie, and we've been like, oh, amazing.
This is a real movie, Jeff. Come on.
It's a poor choice of words. What I mean is a more conventionally shot film.
Right.
Because it like you're saying, David, there's so many up to that point, it felt like this is the best way to tell this. And after that point, it's like, well, we're watching news reports on our screen, and we're also
That may have been too jarring is the thing. Like, switching the mode of how we are operating as an audience abruptly like that. This movie feels like such a delicate balance, right?
We get into cheat. The news reports are a cheat. Like,
they are a cheat.
It's 100%. Because it's like, oh, wouldn't this normally be on a TV? But, oh, no, people can watch news reports on their computers now, guys. You know?
And even a worse cheat is the whole contrivance of the live streamed memorial service people. It's like it literally is established in the movie entirely to create that moment where we're watching a live stream of the memorial service.
But, by the way, how brilliant was that? Like, how the marketing for that memorial startup is like, it's shitty and opportunistic, but it was smart because it got them an active user. even if you're shitty, you got a customer. That's what you wanted.
Also, the choice of stock photo led to them putting together the whole thing.
I have a problem with that because why would he just literally searched for a stock photo and used it, but also then used all of her real personal information of the person in the stock photo, like used her real name and her real age. And like, he wouldn't have done that. He just searched for pretty girl and found her. He wouldn't have like actually used her name, Hannah. I felt like that was,
I actually thought it was a great moment. It's a great, like, holy crap moment in the movie, in my opinion.
And this movie has a lot of great holy crap moments. Like the thing with the whole brother scene too.
Yeah.
It's like, that is tense.
Well, it does such a great job. It does what I love when mysteries do, which is it presents a very plausible solution and then that's not it. And does it again. And that's not it. And it's great because each time John Cho believes it to be true, just like we, the audience, believe it to be true. Like, it's definitely this twerp that blows all of the smoke out of his nose. And you know, he goes, it's like, yeah, punch him in the face. Yeah, we're like, oh, I'm on your side, John. It's definitely this kid. What did you do with his daughter? Oh, no. Okay, wasn't that kid. All right. Oh, my God, it's definitely his brother. Oh, my God, his brother is disgusting. Yeah, choke him. It's so great that we're feeling that way too, and he like goes over the top in both ways, so you can understand that in the third time you go, well, maybe he is wrong again. It's such a wonderful bait and switch, and I love when mysteries do that.
Douglas in the chat room asks, did you guys think for a moment that his brother and daughter engaged in a sexual relationship?
I mean, that was the implication.
It's the implication, but at the same time, in the back of my head, I was also thinking, man, that is really, really dark.
That's really dark.
That's like I don't know if I'm ready to go with you there, movie.
That's like some old boy material right there. Yeah. Like, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's some really messed up stuff. So the ending, it sounds like it didn't work for us for different reasons.
I want to ask you guys this question, though.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
How did you feel about her being alive?
Yeah. I was glad in the moment of watching it, you know, like, oh yeah, at least we got a happy ending out of this. It seems a little too unbelievable, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was a cool thing about having seen the rainstorm, and then later the rainstorm was the reason she was alive. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I also felt like it was a little, you got to have your cake and eat it too.
Right.
Movie. Like,
you took us to the point where we thought she was dead.
Yeah.
And now you're like clawing it back. You know, you made us feel that movie, and now you're like taking it back movie. That's not cool.
Yeah, it's like, no, it's okay. It's all okay. You know. Yeah.
But I don't know. I was rooting for her to be found alive because, you know, John Cho had already lost so much, guys. John Cho had already
lost. That was such a baller moment though. Like, it was it rained. Dun dun dun. The final twist.
It was cool.
Like I think they at least set up a little bit, or it was plausible in the way that, she had access to water and she was still there.
I liked how all of that stuff was seeded in the movie. Like, I definitely saw the moment in the confession tape where the guy looks down and reads the actor. And I thought that was cool. Like, they don't make a big deal out of it, but she's like, you made him read a confession. I many times saw Deborah Messing behave in ways where I'm like, that seems weird. Like, she seems way too emotionally distraught about this but it's like, it all makes sense. And I thought that was kind of rad, that whole, like, in retrospect, all of this makes much more sense.
Although in retrospect, her being the second biggest name in this movie, of course it's her. Of course, like, she's directly tied to it. Yeah.
Well, we have not mentioned the fact that this is the second film that we've reviewed on the podcast this year that has an Asian lead.
There you go.
Which is awesome.
And also two Asian leads, I do want to say too.
Right.
I think Michelle Law, who plays Margot, is really good for the little bits we see of her in this movie.
Yeah. And when he was Anish was talking about when he cast it, we're on a first name basis now.
Cool.
He's talking about when he cast it, the primary goal was to choose someone who would look plausibly like they're from this area of the country, you know, San Jose, right? But also that, hey, by casting an Asian lead, like, then it opens up all these other secondary characters who are also cast in the film, and then they get more opportunities later on. And he's like, wow, like, we're being the change we want to see, like, right now, just by making this single decision. And I thought that was very heartwarming. So, super cool that we had two pretty successful movies led by Asians this August, which is not something that I necessarily saw coming at the beginning of this year. So
yeah, and also it's doing much better than I think anybody had expected to. So is it getting like a bit of the Crazy Rich Asians bump too? Maybe.
Yeah, I mean the main actor in Crazy Rich Asians bought out a theater in support of this movie. And it was hilarious hearing them talk about it because basically, like, nobody, no managers of actors wanted their clients to be involved in this film, right? Because the default position that you would have is that this movie is going to fail, right?
Yeah,
like, movies like this have rarely succeeded, or if they did succeed, it's not necessarily something that, like, you want to point to as, like, this represents, you know, respected actors' best work.
Definitely. Shout out to John Cho for doing this thing. Apparently, like, he had read the script first, and he heard the conceit of doing it through the screens, and he was like, no, immediately. And then, like, Anish talked with him, and I think kind of convinced him it would look very cinematic.
Yeah.
And I think, ultimately, this is, it was a good choice for him, but you know, it follows a lot of really interesting roles for John Cho as well. Like Columbus, I think, is an astounding, gorgeous movie. It's so strange and so unique. At the same time, he's a guy who can go and do Selfie, you know, and be hilarious. So I don't know. Much love to him.
All right.
I want to underscore one other quick thing, please, that Devendra said earlier about how much fun there is in noticing the things all over the screen.
Mm-hmm.
There was a moment sort of, I don't know, 2/3 of the way through where you see him like, you know, working on a website. And one of the banner ads is for depression medication,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I just thought was such a cool little thing of like the algorithm knows that he needs depression.
The algorithm knows. And that's true. That's real life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was great. And there's a lot of stuff like that of things on the side or, you know, file names. I also wanted to mention, I've even mentioned this to my wife. I loved how badass his wife was with like keeping a complete directory of every person his daughter.
Yep,
had.
Over here.
That is the new bar for parenting now.
I know. I was like, honey, we have to do this. This is like, you never know when it's going to come in super handy. And I love like all her notes about who they are and their relationship to it. And if you remember, like that kid was one of the people he clicks on, mm-hmm. that, you know, the Robert or whatever. And it said is obsessed with Margot.
Yeah.
It's like there's a lot of cool seeded stuff throughout.
Yeah, they had
the movie.
To build every asset in this film from scratch. Like every, it's not like they just took someone's computer and randomly did it. You know, like they constructed every file name, every image. You know, So crazy amount of work, but well worth it in our opinion. So that's our review of Searching, and you can find it in theaters right now. I don't know that they did a great job of releasing this film. Like it was, mm-hmm. you know, last week felt like was when the interest peaked. But I think it's expanded a little bit wider this weekend. People have a chance to check it out. I hope you do. And that's our review. Yeah. Find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be reviewing next week. Our theme song comes from adamwarrock.com. Our spoiler bumper comes from filmmaker Kyle Hillinger. Devendra Hardwar, where can I find more of your work on the internet this week?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Devendra and check out my technology stuff at Engadget.com.
Jeff Cannata, how about you?
I'm at Jeff Cannata on Twitter, which is spelled with two N's and one T. And I do a video game podcast that we mentioned a couple of times. It's called DLC. You can find it at 5by5.tv/DLC.
I am no longer on Twitter, but if you want to get updates from me regularly, go to davechen.net/letters, where I compile all the stuff that I would have tweeted into regular emails for you. So davechen.net/letters. Next week, we are going to be recording part two of the Summer Movie Wager 2018, which is to say the results.
Which is crazy because it's anybody's game at this point.
It's crazy how open, like, anything could happen.
Yeah.
So you gotta guarantee you that this episode will be very enjoyable and not at all unbearable. So I'm really psyched to find out who wins the Summer Movie Wager with you guys next week.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. We'll see you next week.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.